So that piece I read from The Atlantic is excerpted evidently from a book that's written by this guy named Garrett Graff on 9/11, Luck Meant Everything. The book is The Only Plane in the Sky. Garrett, welcome to the show. You're on WGN Radio. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me today.
It just dawns on me, maybe I didn't give the title of your book correctly. The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. That's your book, right?
Yes. Yep.
And is that just out now?
Just out yesterday, yep.
So what inspired this? You were on another interview and not listening to my show just moments ago, but I I shared the first anecdote in the Atlantic piece about the guy with the necktie who survives because he went to get a different shirt and his colleague did not. What inspired this? Why did you decide to tell these stories this way?
Yeah, you know, my goal with this book, to tell 9/11 only through the voices of the people who lived it, was to try to capture the emotional experience of living that day. You know, we're at the 18th anniversary of 9/11 now. We're beginning to see this slip from memory to history, a generation of students now coming into the world who don't remember that day at all. And so when we say never forget, what we usually mean are the facts of the day, the four planes, nearly 3,000 Americans killed, Twin Towers, the Pentagon, Shanksville. And what we're losing is the memory of what that day was like to live as an American. And so this book follows 480 Americans coast to coast, morning to night, in their own words, from air traffic controllers to people at the Twin Towers, in the Pentagon, at Shanksville, as well as in the bunker with Vice President Cheney and aboard Air Force One with President Bush. And I think it's so important to remember those voices, to remember what that experience was like, to remember the chaos, the confusion, the fear, and the trauma that they experienced for us, because that was what drove the decisions that people made after 9/11. You know, and we live in this world today, shaped our national politics, our international geopolitics, still very much shaped by 9/11. And yet we sort of forget why we did the things that we did in the wake of 9/11.
I think about that sometimes when I'm at the airport taking off my shoes. Were we taking off our shoes? Actually, I think the shoe bomber was it inspired that, but
yes.
The disrobing for the machines at the airport, I don't remember. We didn't do that before 9/11, right?
No, not at all. And remember, the 9/11 hijackers were able to bring knives and box cutters aboard the plane, which were the weapons that they used that day, because that was allowed under the security regulations. And one of the things that really does come through when you go back and you look at these human voices and look at that experience of that day is the incredible innocence of America on the morning of 9/11. You know, we hear people say now 9/11 changed everything, but we forget just how different things were before. And so, you know, we look back at that first attack, the first crash, and how most of America sort of looked at that with puzzlement. You know, we assumed it was an aviation accident, a pilot having a heart attack, air traffic control having problems. And that one of the things, one of the quotes in the book that I tell is a New York ferry captain who watches that first crash, comes into the Wall Street terminal with his load of morning commuters, and every single one of them gets off the boat and walks into Lower Manhattan, even as papers and envelopes are floating down from the impact of that first plane. There wasn't anyone who sort of looked at that and defaulted to terrorism. That was just not the way that America was thinking that first morning. And of course, now we see those, you know, that video from last month over the summer of a motorcycle backfiring in Times Square and everyone runs for their lives. And what we sort of forget that today we default to thinking it's terrorism. We default to thinking it's an attack or a shooting. Whereas on 9/11, it really wasn't until that second plane hit at 9:03 Eastern time that you began to sort of see people realize that the country was under attack.
I'll get your book. I don't have it today. Normally I've read the book before I put an author on the air, but I just saw this Atlantic piece yesterday and thought, oh, let's jump ahead. You mentioned in the article there's the incredible story of Ladder 6 led by Captain Jay Jonas. Can you tell me a little bit about that story?
Yeah, and this is another example of, you know, the tiny choices that people made that day that ended up saving or costing lives. And Ladder 6 is this incredible story where they actually stop to help save a woman, a civilian, as they are evacuating the Twin Towers. And that puts them, that choice to stop and save Josephine Harris ends up actually putting them in the one place where they are able to survive the collapse of the towers. And they're trapped for much of the afternoon and the hours after 9/11, but eventually rescued, and they all survive that day. And in one of sort of the poignant parts of the epilogue, it was actually years later when Josephine Harris died of natural causes. Ladder 6 showed up, and they were her pallbearers to help carry her into the next stage of her world.
I did not know that story. You mean these guys, maybe gals, were inside the building as it collapsed around them, and they survived?
They survived in the stairwell. They were trapped in one particular part of the stairwell, and actually were able to live.
Maybe that explains. I remember as we were all dissecting what happened in the weeks afterwards, and a colleague of mine at the radio station, there's nothing funny about this, but I remember him hearing the internet rumor about how some firefighters or a firefighter were up in the building and they rode the debris down, sort of slid with the building and survived, kind of gliding down the side as the building collapsed underneath them. And I said, that's impossible. And he said, no, I know, but it happened. A guy actually slid down. That didn't happen, but I guess this did. How hard was it to get people to tell their stories?
So the book is based, as I said, on 480 voices, a mix of original interviews that I did and then some incredible oral history work by institutions like the 9/11 Museum, the Pentagon Historian, the Flight 93 National Memorial, who understood the importance of trying to capture these stories in the initial years after 9/11. And one of the things that has stood out to me in my work and then from conversations with some of the oral historians who worked on these projects as well is just how generous so many people are in telling and sharing their stories for history that day, that they feel in some ways often that sharing their story for future generations is one of the most important things that they can do to help ensure that the world never forgets the trauma of that day.
But the article, too, in the Art magazine, and maybe this is reflected throughout the text, but it's the serendipity of it, right? That there's really no rhyme or reason to who lives and who doesn't in a tragedy. If it was a mass shooting at a mall, a bullet hits you, it doesn't hit the next person. There's no sense to it, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, comes across when you look at the depth of these stories. And the way that day unfolded is that we tell ourselves a much cleaner and neater story 18 years later about what 9/11 was like. That, you know, we know that the whole thing took place in 102 minutes from the first crash to the collapse of the second tower at 10:29 Eastern time that morning. We didn't know that on 9/11. And so to go back, the book really tells the confusion that unfurled as these attacks rippled across the country. Well into the afternoon, people feared other hijacked planes. The Sears Tower in Chicago was evacuated because they feared a plane would attack it. Disney was shut down that day because they feared an attack on Disney. And that this, that confusion and the challenges of that day really helped underscore and really helps to make sense of the decisions that our national leaders made in the wake of 9/11.
Do you have any thoughts about the Taliban being at Camp David this past weekend? I don't know if your writing or research reflects on that in any way.
Yeah, I think the thing that sort of really stood out to me about that is just how much the world that we are living in today is still shaped by 9/11. That this is, even 18 years on, we are still wrestling with the consequences of that day, even as you now have a new generation of American servicemen and women deploying to those war zones who were, as of this year, now born after the attacks themselves. You know, America has never had a war that stretched so long that people who fought in it were not there at the start. Everyone in World War II remembers Pearl Harbor. They knew what they were fighting for. Everyone in the Civil War understood and remembered Fort Sumter. And the idea that we now have a generation of American servicemen and women taking to battlefields for a war that began literally before they were born, that should be a real moment of pause for us as a country.
Think about that. You might read the Atlantic piece on 9/11, Luck Meant Everything. It's in part based on the book, The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. Really interesting storytelling. I'm glad you took the time to do it. Thanks for joining us today, Garrett.
Thanks for having me today.
Garrett Graff.